You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the 3CR Gardening Show. This morning, you're with me, Emma Hurd, landscape architect and horticulturalist. We've got Amy Downey in the studio, horticulturalist from the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, and Kate Archdeacon, who's from My Smart Garden, which runs a series of wonderful free events via your local council. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks, Emma.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Happy International Women's Day.
Indeed.
Yes, happy International Women's Day. What a lovely day to be here.
Yeah.
Beautiful morning as well, yeah. All the good things.
Cool. That's what we want.
Yeah.
I'm loving autumn already. I said the other day to my husband, I was like, the sun is milder already.
Yes. Yeah. Can't you tell the difference? It's amazing, actually. And even just a touch more rain already.
Some of my friends at work who've got vegetable gardens are a bit sad that their tomato window has closed.
I know. I feel that pain too. Yeah. I brought in one of my tomatoes to show. It's just still green. And I thought, oh, put it on the windowsill and see if it will ripen.
Oh,
it's got the slightest blush of orange, but I'm not holding my breath that it will improve. Bit sad and small. This tomato is meant to be the size of an apple, and it's really like, yeah, the size of less than half of an apple.
The comparison that you've got is great. Of the apple next to it, you can really tell how.
In case we weren't sure.
it's not loving life. So it's been a tough season for tomatoes and veggies in general.
And then a lot of things getting eaten unexpectedly and at a much higher level, from what I'm hearing as well.
Why do you think that is? What's going on?
Well, it sounds like it's a lot of pest predation on veggie crops, so maybe overall the food supplies are down across the board, and so the kind of appetite's changing to what's available. Creatures are coming closer to the houses or finding more innovative ways to get through the enclosures and things. That's my thought.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
I did notice a couple of weeks ago quite a large population of the white cabbage moth had blossomed into the world, just plumes of cabbage moth everywhere.
I remember this a couple years ago, actually. Do you remember that?
Maybe it was
2 years ago where there was just an abundance of them.
Yes, I do. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And I think maybe that was a year with quite a lot of rain. But I think now that we're getting, just anecdotally, I feel like we're getting these microclimates of very short bursts of intense rain in places and then no rain for a really long time. But when you get those really intense short bursts of rain, I think the insects almost capitalize on it and they're like, breed, 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 breed. And then you get these profusions of a pest that might be short-lived but quite detrimental to whatever you're doing.
Yes.
And you almost don't have time to act very swiftly to save your veg.
They don't have to be any more effective. There's just a higher critical mass, and so they can still do the same damage.
That's just something I've noticed, but I'd be interested to hear if listeners have experienced the same thing. So call in on 94198377.
I'd
love to hear from you.
I get the free version of Duncan Cocking's leaf, root and fruit newsletter from his garden in Kyneton. And I think I came across him because he teaches phenomenology I think that's the right term, of learning to read the seasons around your in your environment. Yeah. And so he always has really in-depth observations from what's happening on his property, and he's definitely talking about those unexpected changes in the microclimates on his garden. Yeah.
It's quite beautiful to read that sort of observational experience, and it helps you to tap into your own like hyperlocal area.
Mm, yeah.
Gets you in the mood to talk to your neighbours as well.
Absolutely. And I think like people who can teach you how to think, it's going to sound wrong, not think for yourself, that's not what I mean, but how to translate all the book learning and understand what might not be actually right for your garden or your courtyard or whatever. I think that's really important to understand the logic behind the advice that that gets given.
And even to stay curious and be able to ask questions, like, and that there's no such thing as like the right question, but just like pulling at some threads and being like, ooh, okay, this is happening, I wonder why.
Yeah, rather than expecting a certain outcome and then being really disappointed when you and I'm thinking about all this only because I just spent 2 days learning baking from an international skills specialist in baking. And I've been reading baking books for years, and I have learned so much from him teaching us the reasoning behind things, much more in 2 days than I've ever learned from trying to like work my way through these baking books. So that's front of mind for me.
That's so fascinating.
And I think as well, like, being in person really helps.
That's true. Yeah.
And that speaks a bit to what you run a lot of in-person workshops too.
Yeah.
And do you find people just, like, come alive with curiosity in your workshops?
Absolutely. And frustration as well. You know, they're often there because they've tried things, you know, and so they do come with some hard questions. I think our presenters really have to be prepared for that as well. You know, there's a lot of people have gone as far as they can, and then they, you know, they want to sort of see and understand. And a lot of our workshops support that. I know we just ran a composting worm farm and bokashi, and as we know, they're quite different methods and have got really different applications. But I know there was just a preserving workshop that we ran online as well, and that's detailed information that you do need to be able to ask questions and
troubleshooting.
And a lot of the feedback we get in our post-event surveys is like, I had tried, I'd read a lot, I kept making mistakes, now I get it. You know, so that's really good. And particularly
A lot of it's like garden chemistry. So especially with bokashi, you're adding in an enzyme, I think.
Yeah, and what do you do with it? And be prepared for the smell, you know. But I will just say, and I feel like Amy hasn't had a chance to talk much yet, but we did just put up another case study from a resident. So every so often we publish case studies from people who've learned things through My Smart Garden, or just who have really great stories. And one of them was saying that she has learned from the seed propagation, one of the propagation workshops, how to grow the foods that she grew up with in America but can't buy here, and what a difference that's made to her.
Wow.
So that's a great story. And again, as we know, growing from seed is quite challenging if someone doesn't show you how to do it.
Yeah, but once you've got that skill, it's like a powerful skill, isn't it? Like,
just amazing.
Yeah.
For, I'd say, life improvement.
Yeah. One of my friends was just saying his youngest son is fascinated by, I think there's a, they've got a rogue pumpkin seedling coming up. But the little boy,
the best kind of seedling.
But the little boy is just, it's so young, it's still got its casing stuck on one leaf, and he's just like staring at it. I mean, there's not much chance that it's, you know, he's going to want to eat the pumpkin, but just watching this seedling put on, and you know how they put on leaves so quickly.
You never know as well. He might be keener on his veg if he's, you know, participated in the experience of growth.
That's true. They say that for all these school kitchen garden programs, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it makes a difference. I know, like, my daughter's 2 and she has already decided going out and picking the tomatoes is, like, the best thing. So I feel bad for her because they're all green. But I've sort of settled on just letting her do it now.
Yeah.
Isn't that so lovely how early on they get that connection with garden and sort of with nature and with veggies? Like, it's so lovely to see how early it begins.
Oh, yeah. As soon as she could talk, she was saying, flower, flower. Oh. She loves it.
It's so good.
It's great.
I think she's got the perfect mum for her then.
Yeah.
We'll be able to guide her in all the right directions.
I have to keep myself, you know, at bay though. You know, don't want to push her in that direction. You know?
So you'll have an anti-gardening teenager.
Yeah, she seems to like, you know, in nature so far, but you know, no pressure, kid.
Yes.
Just go your own way.
You do you.
Yeah. I do want to say a few years ago I brought some very good friends, their daughter, I brought her a book called Goodnight Veggies. Have you seen it?
I have.
Yeah.
It's a book? No, I don't think so.
But it's just, it is a kid's picture book, and it's a worm wandering through a veggie garden saying goodnight to all the different vegetables and going underground, and, you know, the roots of the leeks are kind of going to sleep and the onions are asleep under the ground, and makes its way a little bit like the Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Yes. Yeah.
But at the end of it, it turns out they're on a rooftop garden in like an inner city, dense urban space. And that's really great.
Oh, my gosh.
But since I gave her that book, whenever she comes to my house, we have to go and open the worm farm and pick up the worms and play with them. And her dad's like, oh, my God. Wash your hands.
She loves it. And he's like, ew.
That's filthy.
Oh, her microbiome will be brimming.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Like, they don't want to play with the toys. We're just going to hang out and, like, pat the worms.
I love that.
I love that too.
You've started something for sure. It's so good.
Yeah.
So, Ames.
Yes.
Tell us, how is the escarpment at RBGV going?
Very, very good. I was up there actually with Tim Ubergang, who's my climbing partner and team leader at the gardens on Friday. And it's just everything is growing. All the recently planted plants are thriving up there. We've had so much success, which is really lucky and really special to see, I think. And it was really special as well. On Friday, we were planting the Eucalyptus stenostoma that, for anyone who doesn't know, I wild collected it with Ollie Sherlock from Cranbourne Botanic Gardens and then also with Threatened Species Conservancy. This was sort of their project. So a eucalypt that was rescued. But we collected the seed that was growing on 300-metre cliff faces in New South Wales. And it's been this amazing project that we've been able to come in and work and collaborate with Threatened Species Conservancy on, because it's endangered and doesn't regenerate from fire. So they had bushfires that burnt through this area in New South Wales. So we went in to collect the seed to give to the Sydney Herbarium to store as a backup, but also for us to grow on and grow on our escarpment and then also distribute to other botanic gardens. So it's been this amazing collaboration. Even Geelong and Gargaro, Bendigo, Ballarat, Castlemaine, lots of people sort of involved in this project. But we were very excited because we finally got to plant it out on the escarpment to hopefully see how it goes, see how it grows up there.
So did you propagate this specimen or did you take this specimen from the wild as a sapling?
We took seed. So, and stenostoma means small opening. So the seeds are these lovely, really round sort of black seeds with this tiny little opening at the top. So we took a lot of seed, and then Cranbourne Botanic Gardens actually grew the seed on. So all the seedlings have been grown on there. And that's the ones that we've planted out and also shared with the other botanic gardens.
Such an awesome process.
Such a special process. To be able to see it all the way through, I think, as well, to do the collecting and then to grow them on and plant them. And then also a lot of the times to be able to hand deliver the seedlings to the other botanic gardens too has been such a beautiful process to be part of, and so special to get to share it with others who've all been really excited to see how they go, sort of see how it works for them in their garden, trial some different like sort of spots to grow them in and get some more information, I guess, on what conditions they do like, how they do grow in certain areas and what that kind of looks like. So it's been amazing. That was sort of the highlight of the climb on Friday. But I was also saying before that we had some Eremophila debilis that was wild collected, not by me, it was maybe a couple of years ago, by Therese Turner and Gemma Cottrell in Queensland. And it's this lovely sort of ground cover native Eremophila with very, very green leaves, and it has these lovely white flowers. It's flowering at the moment, but it's also fruiting, and it's got edible fruits, and I picked some from the escarpment to bring in, and I left them at home. So I'm so sorry that you don't get to try them, but that was the intention.
Maybe we can request a photo for our listeners, and
Absolutely.
We can pop it on our Instagram.
Absolutely. I got a few photos, so I will definitely send them through. Thank and I mean, you. I personally didn't love the taste, so maybe it's a good thing that you don't have to try it early in the morning, but some people do really like it.
Is it bitter?
At the end, it's got a very bitter aftertaste. Mm. It's kind of okay to start with. It's quite not sweet, but just sort of mild in its flavour. And then at the end, it's super, super bitter. Like, I found it really full on.
Mm. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if it would be nice in a certain recipe.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually did read that you can only have them sort of in small doses. Mm. There could be potential toxicity there. So I don't know much about how they've been used or many of the, much of the history of it. But something interesting that I was hoping to share with you, and I'm sorry that I didn't bring them in.
Something else to delve into, though, in the future. So Absolutely. That's nice. And they were collected a couple of years ago, and you planted them on Friday.
No, so we planted these last year, probably mid-last year, and they have just been so successful. They've been growing incredibly. We sort of did a big planting last year, so we also had sort of Eremophila calberry carpet. Another wild collected Wistringia that was, again, not by me, but collected, I think it was sort of lower on a cliff face on the Snowy River. So this amazing trip where they kayaked down this river, and we're collecting plants along the way, and we're able to sort of scramble up a bit and collect some seed. Mm. And Wistringia crenophylla, again, it's this lovely silver foliage. And we planted that last year too, and it's just thriving. And so fascinating to see, because it never did super well in the nursery. It's been planted out in the Australian Forest Walk, never thrived. Now it's on this escarpment, which is very steep, very hot and exposed, very well draining. It's never done better.
So I'm sorry, I'm a bit behind on the escarpment project, but I'm fascinated by this idea that there's a particular climate or ecology that you're focusing on. Can you talk a little bit? Is that okay?
Yeah. So the escarpment, and sorry, I didn't explain it very well. So I'm the curator of the Grey Garden at the Royal Botanic Gardens, and then connected to that is this sort of 40-metre escarpment, which kind of like a small cliff face, north-facing, that sort of reaches down to the tan track below. So it's been this amazing couple of years of myself and Tim Ubergang learning how to climb. So there's anchor points along there. And I will say that this was started pre-me by Alison Rice many, many years ago, and then sort of was a lost art. And then thankfully we've been able to pick it up again and sort of learn these skills. Mm. So we sort of learned to abseil and climb, not only to sort of use it, I guess, to this space to display a whole different sort of range of plants and cliff-dwelling species, but we've also now been able to use it as sort of a place to hold ex situ collections of a lot of threatened species. And not only is it perfect because a lot of these species that we have grow really well on cliff faces, we've also been really lucky that a lot of them maybe are threatened due to poaching and theft and things like that.
It's hard for people to get to them.
It's very hard, very protected spot.
Yeah.
So that's just a little bonus there too. But yeah, it's been a wonderful journey of sort of having to navigate that space, and, you know, erosion and weed control was a huge part of the learnings, and we ended up using jute mat to sort of be able to, I guess, control some of those weeds that are just out of control. And, you know, we found the more we were pulling out, the more erosion there was.
Mm.
And so we knew that we wanted to plant a lot of plants to help, you know, use the roots to help with that stabilization. So using jute mat and then planting into the jute mat has sort of been the process that we've been going along with. So it's been amazing. I could talk about it forever. I don't want to you know, use up too much time. But
for listeners that aren't familiar with this part of the garden, if you enter via City Gate,
yep,
you'll be right in proximity to this escarpment garden, and you can stand in the Temple of the Winds, and
yes,
it's a beautiful part of the garden. I would say, I mean, you're there day to day, Amy.
Yeah.
Would you say it's one of the less frequented areas?
I do feel like you're really, it's slightly out of the way, so you're usually going there
deliberately.
Yeah, exactly. It's not something maybe you would just accidentally stumble across. Mm. And it can be a tricky spot too, because it's not all access. The grey garden, which you need to sort of go down, has really steep steps. Mm. So, yes, I feel like it's not something you accidentally find, but you're sort of going to with the purpose of maybe looking at the temple. It's got a beautiful lookout of the river and the city.
Yeah. A lot of effort has gone into this area in recent years. I was lucky enough to help document the city gate before it
beautiful
was...
Beautiful gates.
You know, during the design process.
Yeah.
With APL and Andrew Laidlaw. From that process, I just know how much love and care has gone into upgrading the area. So even Temple of the Winds got a facelift.
Yeah.
It's looking beautiful. And that was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah,
so
yep.
Basically what I'm trying to say is get yourself down to that part of the garden, because it's really nice. You know, bring a picnic, sit for a while.
I'd like to ask actually, and Emma, you can probably talk about this a little bit. I've noticed that the arts in the kinds of spaces where I think of them as being quite traditional and conservative, and I'm thinking about something like exhibition design at the NGV is extraordinary now. It's still really respectful of the history of the art and work, but it's really fresh and engaging as well. It's finding a really beautiful balance, I think. Mm. And just, I feel like there's probably some understanding that you both have about how the Botanic Gardens gets upgraded or managed or restored, and that maybe you could talk a little bit about what is the overarching sort of the ethics or principles or, you know, goals about like maintaining something that's so traditional but needs to be fresh and relevant and adaptive because it's outdoors.
Yeah. You
know, I was just curious about that.
Well, I think Amy can speak to it more broadly because she's there full time. I sort of dip in and out of it depending on what design work is in process. But from my experience, because I worked on the sensory garden, the arid garden, drylands, and City Gate and Tacoma Gate and one other gate. Anyway, besides the point. So those projects all, I would say, have a big emphasis on collections. So really the thinking about the plants first is really important, and engaging with the hort team. And then that is what flows through to the design process and making sure that the plants are the heroes every step of the way. I think as an institution, RBGV do a lot of work in comms for trying to make sure that even after the design's finished, that the interps team comes in and does beautiful signage and tells the story of what the gardens are trying to convey to people. I think also... correct me if I'm wrong, Amy, but the gardens recently with the executive team having such big changes is going through a transition phase. So, I think a lot of new, fresh ideas are coming through in that phase. There's obviously a lot of emphasis on connection to country and recognition of the Indigenous peoples. There's three tribes that actually engage with the land.
Right.
So that's rich in cultural significance. So that's always a focus during the design process to try and consult with those people and make sure that their voices are sort of heard throughout the narrative of the design. Mm. I don't know if that speaks to your question.
Oh, absolutely. There's so much I didn't know about in that answer.
And I would, I don't do the concepts of the designs. That's Andrew Laidlaw. So he's the lead landscape architect at RBGV. But yeah, I'm more involved in the development of the design and the detailed drawings.
Mm.
So that's my role in it. But yeah, I can definitely say that it's a really fun experience working with RBGV, and that there's a huge amount of care that goes into the gardens. And so, yeah, I think it's an incredible place to go for free.
Mm.
And whenever you can, you know, nab one of the horticulturalists, like if you see them, you know, working and they look like they're up for a chat, take the opportunity.
Always.
Yeah, take the opportunity, because, you know, speaking to the people that work there every day and attending for the plants, that's the best. And that's why we love having Amy in the studio.
Oh, yeah.
And
other
members of the RBGV team. It's so lovely.
That's very kind. Thank you. And I do want to say that, you know, you answered that perfectly, and I think it's a massive credit to the work that you and Andy Laidlaw and the team do, because it's not an easy task to always be coming up with fresh new ideas. And as you said, there's so many points and people to include, and you're so good at doing that and having that focus there for the traditional owners while keeping a plant focus. There's so many things you have to think of, and you do such a wonderful job with every project. They're always, I think, just to perfection, and they always get such highly regarded comments, I think, about them. So yeah, just a massive well done to you guys, and we're so lucky to have and be able to work with you.
Oh, right back at you, Ames.
Thanks.
It's a wonderful place to get to work, I think.
I agree.
I think it's fascinating listening to you talk about it, and the interaction of the, you know, the people and the animals and the plants. Yes. As well. I mean, it is in a lot of ways. My husband was there on Friday night with friends at the Marlon Williams gig, yeah. I think. And I think about, like, the amount of traffic that would go through that space, and just trying to integrate all of the ecosystems in that. And I have an agenda on raising that just because I'm so interested in how that happens in cities generally as well. And so interesting that you can have a plant first kind of approach.
Yes.
And create a beautiful space. And, you know, I feel like some of that thinking is really starting to show up in forward thinking cities around the world as well. Yeah, so if we get a chance to talk about some of that stuff later, I'd love to. But it seems like we're getting some messages in as well, is that right?
Yeah. So we do have a few fun giveaways for this episode of our show. The Fernie Creek Hort Society is holding their Plant Collectors Expo and Flower Show, and that's coming up on the 18th of April and the 19th of April, so it's a weekend. It's free entry for members and under 18s, but it's $9 per non-member. It's going to be a really fun weekend. It's a celebration of all things green, featuring the most unique and awe-inspiring plants from exhibitors and vendors. So think flower displays that will be judged, informative garden tours, plant sales, including rare plants, of course, and cut flower sales, and there'll be a sausage sizzle and hot and cold drinks. So there's plenty of free parking on the footy oval. And luckily for us, they have kindly given us 3 double passes for us to give away. So all you have to do is call in now on 94198377 and talk to our wonderful producer, Pia. Give her your name, and the name will be popped on the gate for you to you and a friend to get in free. Another freebie that we've been given to give away this morning is from Open Gardens Victoria. They kindly give us a free double pass pretty much to every garden of their season, so we're very lucky. Thank you, Open Gardens. This one is for Sunnymead in Anglesey, which will be open on Saturday the 14th and Sunday the 15th of March, so next weekend. So we've got 1 double pass for that garden. A little bit about it. It belongs to Peter and Simone Shaw. And they're I think their company's called Great Ocean Road Gardens. Anyway, they also do design projects. So if you're inspired by their garden and you want one of your own, you can engage them. So their garden's set amongst mature messmate gums, and the garden is a model of what can be achieved by retaining existing vegetation but planting a garden at home with minimal impact on the environment. So it sounds like a beautiful place to visit. Have either of you been? No.
No.
I've been to Sunnymead. I can say it's really lovely. And even bring a picnic or, you know, something like that to take.
I definitely will be visiting. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's lovely. Mm. So again, if you'd like to win that double pass, 94198377. So I'll leave those there for now. But we've got plenty of other community announcements. I might spread them out throughout the show. We've got a message from Frank in Noble Park. He says, there's no one selling seed potatoes, tomato seedlings and pumpkin seedlings in Noble Park. How can he go about growing it in his own garden? Have you ever just popped some potatoes in the ground from the supermarket?
Well, I must have. They probably weren't from the supermarket.
Yeah, maybe from a local market or something.
Yeah, I tend to buy direct. But I didn't mean to, but I found potatoes growing in my compost in where I'd spread compost in my veggie patch. And, yeah, so clearly I must have put them in at some point and then they grew and then I found them again. And I actually thought someone had kind of stuck them in there to trick me. But, no, other people have better things to do with their time. Yeah, absolutely. I know the only – so seed potatoes are certified seed potatoes disease-free, and that's the risk that you take if you're not buying seed potatoes, like so buying them from the supermarket or the market. You can certainly order – there's quite a few plant suppliers that will sell send you seed potatoes and some – and seedlings as well. I know diggers do speedings.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as we were talking about before, pumpkins come up all by themselves.
Now's a good time to have your pumpkins in the ground. I'd say with tomatoes.
It's probably a bit late.
Yeah, it's a bit late for tomatoes unless you have a greenhouse. But, you know, never say never. If you want to keep them inside as well near a warm window, just do a bit of experimenting. But, yeah, my advice would be seeds.
And seed potatoes maybe just in come and get in the post.
Ordering them online. But, yeah, unless you're willing to drive further afield to find a different nursery that's outside your local area, then, yeah, I think online stores are great.
Yeah, you're right. I agree, growing from seed, but at the right time. Like, I don't know if Frank's talking about tomatoes right now, but certainly getting a pack of seeds and starting them in, I don't know, July, August, something like that, starting them inside so they're ready to plant out that's pretty easy. And tomatoes do sprout really easily, don't they?
They do.
They're always coming up out of the compost as well, where you don't want them.
Yeah, exactly.
Always the way.
We've actually got our wonderful host, Virginia, on the line to talk about a walk through the gardens. So I'll pop her on here. Good morning, Jen.
Hi, darling. I am doing a walk in the Botanic Gardens on Sunday the 22nd in the morning at 10:30.
That's a nice time of day.
It's a lovely time of day, and I thought if people were interested in what Amy has been talking about, I could direct my walk to there.
Oh, that's very great
idea.
Well, I thought it'd be good, Amy. And as most of our listeners know, I'm a guide at the Botanic Gardens, and that's when my next walk is, the 22nd of this month.
That's so exciting to hear. I hope maybe you might get up there if people are interested, but I do know it's quite far, again, away from many of the other special sites, so no pressure.
Well, my walks often are longer than they're meant to be.
So wear hiking boots, is that what you're saying?
Where do you start?
And also, to Frank in Noble Park, I find pumpkins and potatoes are always coming up in my compost from what I throw in there.
Yeah.
You go. Where do you start your walk at the Botanic Gardens? Where do people meet you?
We start at the Visitor Centre, which is up the, I suppose you'd call it the city end, there's a cafe there, so you can get a cup of coffee while you're waiting. The shop's there, which is a good place to find things.
Yeah,
for presents and things like that.
Is that called Observatory Gate?
Observatory Gate. That's beautiful. Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. I know they changed the names of the gates not that long ago, so yes, sometimes it's a bit confusing for people.
Still adjusting. Yeah.
Yeah. We went from the alphabet to.
I'm still completely on ABCD.
Yeah. Me too. Me too.
Yeah.
But, you know, one day I'll.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will find you. Just talk really loudly nearby.
Yes, and I thought. Amy's store, wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Do people have to book in to come on the walk, Virginia?
There is a limit, right. But I always go over the limit as well because I've got a big voice. I don't mind. But yes, there's limited. You can book online or you can just turn up.
Mm, yeah. Great. Wonderful.
I'll make sure to get in the garden this week then, Virginia, and make sure it's looking lovely for you and ready.
Okay, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
Happy International Women's Day, Virginia.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And it's my daughter's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
What a special day.
A very special day.
Yeah.
Cake.
Yes. Yeah.
Indeed.
Celebration.
Okay. Bye all.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm always hoping that I bump into Virginia on one of her walks. We haven't quite managed it yet, but, yeah, that's exciting to hear.
It's such a big place as well. You think you'd, like, see each other more often. But it's
amazing
like...
how much you can, you know that you're going to be in the gardens at the same time and still never cross paths.
Because I was wondering, I mean, presumably it's not a 9-to-5 Monday to Friday job that you have. Like,
yes.
How does that work? Do you work all different days of the week or?
Yeah, so mine is Monday to Friday and we sort of start anywhere between, especially in the summer, 6, 7:45-ish. We have quite a broad starting time and then usually finishing again between 3 and 4. And then so a Monday, Tuesday is what we call a day in our area. So that's when I'll be in the Grey Garden or the Escarpment or, you know, our collections, just sort of working independently on our collections. And then the rest of the week is sort of team-based work.
Mm.
So I always try on a Monday, Tuesday. That's when I'm sort of looking out for people and always up for chats then too because you're in your collection and sort of have your own time to do what you need.
Right. So Monday, Tuesdays are the good times to go to an area and ask the person in that area about that area.
Absolutely.
Okay, top tip.
Yes, that's the top tip, yeah.
Do you ever sort of commandeer your colleagues from other areas and be like, look, I've got this thing, I really need an extra pair of hands, like often. Come join me.
Yeah, often. And we love it because then you sort of, you know, you work a little bit in my area together and then a little bit in yours. And sometimes there are those jobs where you just need an extra pair of hands. And we love it because the things you learn from working with that person in their sort of niche area where all their expertise lie, you just get the best tips and things.
I bet on, you know, like the hot 40-degree days, everyone's like, hey, Lloyd, do you need a hand in the fernery? Like, I'll come help you.
Everyone's running to Fern Gully on those days. Yeah.
So. Turn the misters on. Like, yes, watering, it's our key priority.
Absolutely. That's usually what happens.
Yeah, I mean... Can't blame you. I think it's and probably quite necessary to stay out of the heat and find tasks that need doing somewhere shady.
And then vice versa, I guess, in the winter, often, especially me, running up to the Grey Garden to get that sort of warm sun that's always
north
up
facing,
there.
Exactly. Yeah, spread out along the escarpment. Yeah.
And along with all the lizards up there.
So good.
Yeah.
Do you get any snakes?
No snakes. And I believe there has never yet... that we know of been a snake in the gardens.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I'm sure they're there and we just haven't seen them. But
there such a contrast to Cranbourne.
Very, very different. Yeah.
I'm not sure if John's told stories on air and I won't tell it. I'll leave it to John if he hasn't. But there's one particular snake. It has a name and it keeps coming back into Cranbourne.
Yes, like I've heard this story.
The snake catcher comes and takes it away and then just back again in
it's
like
just
a week.
All the staff know it. It's just part of the team at this moment. It's just,
regular. Kind of love it. So good. Are there any animals like that in the city gardens?
that just come back.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think that often a lot of the hort team have a bird that just sort of knows and comes whenever you're in the collection. It will just come and sort of be with you. Oh. So I've got one of the little, we have lots of magpies that do that, where they seem to just remember you and sort of come and garden with you whenever you're in your collection. And it's often what we think is the same one. Mm. The same, I have a little like blackbird. What are the ones they've got the orange beaks and they're completely black and small?
Yeah, it is a, yeah, I think it's a blackbird.
Blackbird.
The little, with the yellowy orange beaks.
Yes, yeah.
If they like digging, it's probably a blackbird.
That's the one. In the Camellia collection, every time I'm there, it's always, and I believe it's the same one, always there sort of digging, scratching next to me.
Mm.
So lovely though. Lovely little companion.
Yeah.
To garden with.
Oh, I love to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
We do have another message from Frank. He's got a follow-up question. Mm. Where can he buy vanilla orchids? Ooh. So I know diggers have had them in the past, and mm-hmm. I know I've had one from Bullion Art and Garden the past.
Is that the same as the vanilla lilies, like the chocolate lilies?
Yeah.
No, not
different.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so the chocolate lily, you can, there's a native.
Yeah, and the native vanilla lily. Sorry, yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Ignore me.
That's all right. Easy to get them mixed up. But I would say the vanilla orchids in Melbourne, I would keep them as an indoor plant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not impossible, but it is tricky to get a vanilla bean from them. They do like the warmth. I know there are more vanilla farms in Queensland.
That makes sense.
And I imagine that's where they're brought down from to sell in Victoria.
Yeah.
So definitely, like, once you've got your plant, be aware not to just put it outside as we're coming into autumn and winter.
Mm.
And also they do not like to have wet feet. They'll rot. So all the best finding one. And I know that they'll order them for you if you can't find one easily. So, yeah, good luck, Frank. Mm. A message for our listeners. All the passes have been given away. Thanks for calling in and snapping them up. Have fun at the Open Gardens.
Yes,
and
enjoy.
At Fernie Creek. We've got a couple more text messages. Good morning. Fantastic hearing about Amy's work at the RBG follow up to her New South Wales seed collection expedition last year. Did anyone visit the Open Gardens at Mansfield yesterday and can talk about it? Thanks, Susie. Oh, I did not. Did either of you?
No, unfortunately.
No, sorry, Susie.
Because I know the Mansfield one... trying to remember, it's the Barwidian Garden, and that's also on today for anyone that's interested in it. It's 3 acres on a broken river near Mansfield in northeast Victoria.
Mm-hmm. Have you visited before, Emma?
No, I haven't been before, unfortunately. Mm. So I might put the call out to listeners. If you went yesterday and you've got some nice things to talk about, give us a call on 94198377. I know it's a bit of a hike for Melbourneites to get there, but yeah, if you've gone and you've got some tales to tell,
yes,
give us a call.
Please.
Thanks, Susie, for that question. Mm. And then another text message. Yesterday we went to the Red Hill show for the first time. There were lots of wonderful tomatoes and heaps of other terrific fruits and vegetables on the judging tables. There were, of course, the usual animals. Ah, yes. Cows and chickens and pigs, I imagine. But, yeah, that's a nice day trip to Red Hill, and stop for some wine at a winery as well, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And then the Ceres Harvest Festival is coming up on March 21st, and I'm fairly certain I heard that I'll be there anyway, but I heard that the community hall, half of that's going to be for vegetable and fruit judging.
Ooh.
So,
bit
you
of
know,
local competition.
That's right. Biggest beetroot. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that. That'll be good.
Are you judging?
No. I'm going to have a stall there, but no, I won't be judging. Okay. I'll go and taste everything afterwards.
Yeah. And I'm hopeful as well that maybe there'd be some like pie competitions or.
I'd hope so, yeah. It's going to be huge, I think. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to it. It'll
21st.
21st, March 21st, 10 till 3. Yeah. So,
awesome. Yeah. And you'll have a little stall talking about My Smart Garden, or what are you doing?
It's my whole other world, which is making stoneware bowls for food and cooking. So, yeah, it's totally different. Beautiful. I shouldn't talk about it in this context at all.
Oh, no, by all means, talk about it. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, the whole food, gardening. Yeah, it's all connected. You know, yeah, very... very hands-on. A lot of what I do is very hands-on. So, yeah.
I know one of our other panelists, Sandra Schwartz, she has her stall.
I was at Ceres on the stall next to Sandra last Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
She's got her book and she makes these gorgeous, I think they're called like worry
gobblers.
Worry gobblers, that's it. And
what
they're,
is that?
They're just these cute little like soft toys. And they're just meant to like soothe you.
Well, you can write or draw something that's worrying you and then you unzip the mouth of your little buddy and then you put it in and zip it up and they take care of it for you. And then the adults in your life, if it gets a bit full, they take it out for you. They don't read it.
Yep.
But then they take care of it for you.
That is so lovely.
Isn't that
the best? What a wonderful idea. Yeah.
And you know, the world knows there's so much to worry about at the moment. So
they're very cute.
Yeah.
Yeah. I defy anyone to resist them.
So a bit of a plug for Sandra. Get along and support. And, of course, we know her beautiful book is also for sale.
Yes.
It's great, actually. And I know she's getting very busy to do a lot of international talks. So, you know, try and run into her when you can because she won't be around necessarily that long.
This is true. This is true. I think she's got a conference in Japan and speaking at a German one as well. So wonderful.
So wonderful. Congratulations, Sandra. That's just amazing. So
International Women's Day.
Woo-hoo! Absolutely. Yep.
Yep. Got a spree kit.
I think she was telling me today she was doing more making because she's doing really well. So, we were going to meet up after this, but she's actually making more gobblers. Yeah.
That's so good.
That's so lovely.
Oh, I love it. I have to get one for my daughter.
Yes.
She's not quite at the worrying age yet. That's one day.
That's
one
good. Day. You'd be prepared.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'm so lucky to have Sandra in my life. She was my colleague at APL. So she's a landscape architect as well as an author and a horty. But I'll just say as well, she has bought some beautiful books for my daughter on about birds and gardens and circling back to what you were saying about buying books for young people, I just think, the sooner you can get nature-based ideas into their life, the better.
Mm-hmm.
So, lucky to have a friend that thinks of those things and gifts them. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we have another lovely text message. Collector's Corner currently have vanilla orchids. There you go, Frank.
Mm.
They are on the pricier side, $50, but I think that reflects, you know, the transportation and the fact that they're one of the rarer things you can find in Melbourne. We bought one many years ago and it's now almost covered the back wall of our hothouse.
Wow.
We also have a smaller plant of the variegated leaf form. Ooh, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
I've never actually seen the variegated
one. Me neither.
So cool. I wonder, I don't imagine that would change the vanilla bean at all, but yeah. Oh, I'm interested. That's really cool. Mm. Thank you for texting that in. You can text us. I should mention our text number is 0488 809 855. And thankfully, it seems like lots of our lovely listeners have our mobile number saved in their phone. Because that's the first time I've mentioned it this morning. So apologies, everybody. Give us a text. So we can talk about some plants if we like. What sort of things have we brought in today, Amy? Anything?
Okay. I brought a few different things. One of them was, since we were talking about it before, is a seedling of the Eucalyptus stenostoma that was well collected on that 300-metre cliff face. But I brought it in because I didn't notice this at the time on the mature trees, but as we've grown them as seedlings, they've got this amazing purple under their leaves that is just the brightest, and even this one is not actually as purple as it was previously. And as they mature, I've noticed that a lot of them have lost it. But I thought I definitely want to bring it in because it's just beautiful and so stunning to see. The colour was so lovely.
Gorgeous. It's like magenta almost.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that divine. Was one I thought, I've spoken about it a lot, so I have to bring in a seedling to show.
Can I have a closer look?
Yes,
great. Please. Broad leaf as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And the really early growth almost looks like a tendril.
Yeah.
Mm, like it's got lovely shape to it.
It does.
And these tiny little leaves on the new growth.
Yeah.
And then they sort of start out, or actually I'm guessing they start out pointed and then they get wider.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Mm. It's so interesting. They came on so quickly as well from seed. I feel like that's probably pretty common for a eucalypt to grow so fast. But
did you have to treat the seeds much?
No.
No?
No, not at all. They were very, very easy to propagate, which is amazing.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So that is one of my many that I've brought in.
Yes.
I also brought in on a slightly, this one's not a native, it's an exotic. And so this one is called, hang on if I can get it out of the cup, Polygonum scoparium. Do you know this one?
No.
So I would say, I would describe it to almost look ephedra-like, do you think?
Mm.
Kind of got an ephedra vibe to it.
Yeah.
It's almost leafless. And then all along the stems, it's got these tiny white flowers that often, it does have a little bit of a scent. See if you can smell that. They're known for having a bit of a smell, but you can smell that?
Yeah, it's got that kind of florally, you know, the way some of the bottle brushes, the yellow bottle brushes have that kind of mild, buttery, sweet smell.
Yes, that's a really good way actually to describe it. Yes.
Yeah, perfect. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. So this is, you know, it's sort of ground cover as well, and then probably only grows, I mean, I prune it quite hard, but it probably grows to just under a metre. And then lots of these sort of stems coming up everywhere.
It looks like it would be really hardy.
Super hardy. So this is growing at the Grey Garden in full sun, rocky, sort of coming out of rocks, really well-draining soils. Mm. And it's from Corsica and Sardinia.
Mm.
So sort of a not super common one, but a lovely one that I just adore getting to walk past and see it. And there's quite a huge patch of it at the Grey Garden. So I love getting to sort of be amongst it, and even pruning it down is quite fun because it's
does it cope well with pruning?
Very well. Right. I think I prune it maybe to one or two nodes. Really, really hard every year, and it just comes back so quickly. So
I think that's something that's really nice about your garden is that there's plants from all over the world represented there.
Yes, that's true. Yes, absolutely. It's probably one of the most diverse, thank you, collections in the gardens because it really can be, it could be indigenous. We've got indigenous, native, exotic species. It can be any kind of plant. It could be a salvia. It could be a cactus.
Mm.
Really, the only criteria is that, you know, it has maybe a grey-blue sort of foliage to it or adaptations, and that it can handle that sort of really hot and harsh exposed site. So a lot of them as well are very climate match for our future climate as well. It's a good place to get some inspiration for that too.
Yeah.
But so varied. It's so wonderful to get to work with such a mix of plants.
Mm.
And there also is, as part of that collection, there's a really strong Canary Island influence, which is another one of the plants that I brought is from Canary Islands, because I believe it actually used to be the Canary Island collection and then it sort of flowed into the Grey Garden. So it still has that really strong influence, and I think, again, probably to do with the maybe temperature and the site that it's so exposed that they both grow really well together, which is lovely. So also then I will mention this plant from the Canary Islands, which is Crotalaria.
Mm.
So have you? Do you know this one?
It's yes. So beautiful. I happened to come across one that I believe was self-seeded at Periander Gardens.
Yes. Yeah. I think some species can be a little bit weedy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's... But it looked so out of place because it was in the rockery area, which makes sense.
Yes.
Given that you've planted it in your rockery area. I thought, ooh, that's so tropical looking. Because it's got, like, I guess it's in the Fabaceae family.
It is.
And it's got its little pea flower. It's gorgeous.
I think they kind of look like little doves almost, little birds sort of all along the stem here.
Yeah.
So I have to admit, we don't actually know this is a spur, so we don't actually know the species of this one. I have never had any trouble with it being weedy, but I do know some other crotalarias can be.
Yeah.
I just thought it's just one of those ones. Again, the flowers to me are just so stunning, very much like a little dove hanging off the stem.
Yeah, and they've got that beautiful. So there's a purple around the base of the flower. And then it goes into this amazing sort of lime green almost, or is it just my eyes in
the
light?
No, you're spot on.
Yeah. And it does look like something you could like chew on.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It's very pretty. It's a good one.
And you were holding it horizontally, but is it a vertical? Does it just grow upwards?
Yeah, it's vertical. Yeah. I just feel like it shows the good shape of the flower that way. But yes, often like that. And then usually covered sort of a lot of the way down. Or, you know, maybe like a quarter of the way down.
With the flowers.
In the flowers. Mm. Yeah.
And is it more of an annual or is it a perennial?
I think it's mine behaves like a perennial.
Yeah.
Flowering every year, and there are a few that I think they've been there a long time, the ones that I have, because there are a couple that died, but there's still many that are going strong, so definitely perennial.
And do you think we always think about like the pea family as nitrogen fixers, are they helping, do you think? Are you worrying about them as kind of contributing to the soil or anything like that, or
I'm not sure, probably a lot to be honest. Consider, really. I haven't noticed them having any effect.
Not everything next to them is not like five times bigger than it should be or something.
Now I have to think about it. No. I mean, not noticeably to me. I think everything that's sort of around it is behaving as it should. Mm. But again, I probably have four maybe individual plants, so maybe it's because they don't have so many that it's not having that effect, but I will definitely be keeping an eye out now because I am interested.
What sort of pods does it make? Do the pods look the same as the flowers?
I have to admit, I actually don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know if they're a little bit inconspicuous. I've just never noticed them because I always notice when it's flowering, it's sort of down under the temple in a spot I don't always get to. I couldn't tell you what the pods look like.
Yeah, cool.
I'll have to keep my eye out.
Yeah.
To have a look. It's one of the ones I just haven't noticed. So whether it's a very subtle pod.
Yeah. So for the listeners at home, what's the name of that one again?
Crotalaria. It's a spur. If I had to have a guess, maybe I shouldn't, but I had a little Google at some different species and there was one that was Agataflora, which I think looks the most similar to this one if you just wanted to have a look. But I can't say that it's that species for sure.
Mm.
But I do know, again, having a little look into Crotalaria, it was saying that some Crotalarias were used in for medicine and things like that. So I think they're quite an interesting genus. But again, just a warning that I think some can be weedy too. Mm-hmm. So just a good idea to have a little bit of a look and research into them.
Mm.
Yes. Well,
thank you for bringing it in. It's lovely.
No worries.
Lovely to see.
No worries.
And one of the ones that, you know, you don't see that frequently.
Yes, even in the grey garden, it's a little bit hidden, so you've got to kind of search for it. But, yeah, I haven't seen it anywhere else in the garden, so.
Very nice.
There's a couple of other ones still to see as
well. Oh, would you like me to keep going?
Let's keep rolling.
I'd love to.
Let's do it.
Well, Emma has already had a guess at this one, and I will say that the hint is that Andrea Proctor was a bit of an inspiration on her What Is It Wednesday.
Right. But could she you runs guess, that Kate? On her Instagram page.
Yes.
It looks very tropical to me, and if I guessed, I would say it was a sapote. But
good guess.
Okay.
Good
guess. But not quite
not
right.
Not quite. Yeah. So for the listeners, I would describe it's got a very big fruit on it that actually fell off, and it almost looks like an apple. And then these very sort of long, how do you say this, serrated?
Yeah, very serrated around the short serrations around the edge, aren't they?
Around the edge leaves. Of the yeah. leaves. And yes, very tropical looking. But this is actually a camellia.
Is it?
Camellia trichocarpa.
Wow.
Yes. One of the ones, again, massive. Have a feel of that super heavy sort of apple-looking fruit.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, someone earlier said bit like a pomegranate as well.
Yes. Sort of. Yep. Sort of starting to turn a little bit red on the outside. They're most of them at the moment that are still young are very green.
Mm.
I think as the sun gets them, they're sort of turning a bit redder, amazing. A dark red. Yeah,
it's really leathery, almost like the pomegranate skin, aren't they?
Yes, you know, yeah. yes. So it gets these massive, really sort of thick-looking seeds, three seeds inside.
Hence the trichocarpa.
Yeah, trichocarpa, yes. Yes, I wonder if that means, does that mean three seeds?
That would just be my guess, yeah. three, but.
Yeah.
You can sort of see where it started as a flower.
Yep.
Yeah.
Beautiful sort of white, quite large white flowers that actually have a scent to them as well. Mm. A lovely one. And I mean, it's such a lovely camellia where it's got a really lovely form, sort of a smaller tree and almost cinnamony coloured bark on it. So it's got a bit of an orange tinge to it. It's one of my favourite camellias. It's such a lovely one. And I believe it's from Yunnan. Oh. I think it's sort of... Is that southern China?
Yes.
Yes, southern China area it's native to. Beautiful. So, again, inspired by Andrea Proctor, because sometimes, you know, we recognise the camellias for their beautiful flowers, but some of the fruits of them are just spectacular to see.
And camellias, like the sinensis is the tea plant, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was talking to – there's someone I've met who gets – not wild harvested, but kind of wild harvested tea, fermented tea. He buys it from small growers in China.
Wow.
But what he says there is they don't have tea plantations as such. They actually go out into the forest because the camellia grows as a really tall tree. And so they climb up and harvest the tips and then they ferment that and that becomes a particular type
of tea. The tips of the leaves.
The leaves.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So when you let them go, they, you know, they're, so I'm just imagining, and that is such a story from looking at these leaves and the fruit. You can totally imagine being out in maybe those sort of temperate or subtropical rainforests and, you know, harvesting tea in the wild like
and
that.
Quite a nice, unique leaf for a camellia compared to, you know, the camellias we see in cultivation.
Yeah. I find the species do have quite very, I mean, even the really popular one, the Nitidissima, which is the yellow flowering camellia, which I think is so popular because of that flower.
Mm.
But even the leaves of that are so large and glossy, just beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I find a lot of the species do have sort of lovely and varied leaves on them.
Mm. Yeah. So where is that growing? Like, where did you find that? Is that in your garden?
So I also look after the camellia collection. So two very varied gardens. But yeah, so we have sort of two beds that are part of that collection, and one is designated to a lot of the cultivars and the other is a lot more of the species. So that's growing there, sort of visible from the road and very close to the Crapneliana, which I've spoken about before, which has a really orange bark.
Oh,
that's another
right.
camellia there. And you can see, because the fruits are so big, you can see them too from the path. So definitely worth having a look if anybody's around and interested in their camellias.
It looks beautiful. Fantastic.
Yeah. And about to be, you know, some of the sanquis and things have some buds on them, so about to be the time to come and swat some flowers too.
Yeah, definitely a good time to go have a look at that part of the garden. And if you're in the Dandenong Ranges, starting to be a good time to visit Dandenong Ranges Botanic Gardens too. Yeah. I think some of their early camellias will be kicking off soon.
Yes, yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always. Thanks for letting me share.
Pleasure. That's a lot of great. Yeah, thank you for bringing it in.
Oh, of course. Well, as I was saying,
the only thing that's going really well in my garden is the silver beet that I'm planting ahead of winter. So I didn't feel like that was worth, like, really harvesting and bringing in.
Oh, we still would have loved it.
Yeah.
Still would have loved it.
Passed it around to munch on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my mustard leaves are just getting you know, I've planted all my mustards for winter, so they're kind of getting sort of, they're probably about 5 to 8 centimetres across. So for once, I might have got my timing right, possibly. I don't want to jinx myself, but it might work.
I feel like it's going to be a better season for winter crops than it was for summer crops.
That's my hope.
Maybe it's just wishful thinking. Please.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah.
But yeah, it sounds like you've got some good things in the ground. Any others that you're hoping to get in?
I'm playing around with, so I've just changed to raised beds, finally, after fighting my soil for so long. Because I'm on heavy clay up in the north. And I'm trying to get my head around crop rotation and also edible green manures. So I think when I take out I've got one bed that's got tomatoes with flowers and no fruit and a very excited cucumber and stuff. So that will be, that's kind of the summer production bed. And I'd say it like that. It's 600 wide. It's not very big. But anyway.
That's all you need.
But I've been reading about green manures and soil health, and that you trying to keep things living in the soil all season, and then you're sort of managing how much nutrient you take out of it. Yeah. So I think that's a long way of saying when I clear that bed, I'm going to put in more mustard seed, but probably edible mustards so that we can harvest as well rather than just having to leave it completely fallow. So it's just, I'm always experimenting and basically ignoring what the books say so that I can do what I want, which always backfires, but I can't help myself.
I'm sure it doesn't always backfire. That sounds like there must be some, you know.
I've thought about it a lot. And, yeah, there's a great book that I've picked up actually in Hobart a few years ago from the Seattle Urban Farm Company called Grow More Food, and it's got a very stepped out explanatory way of thinking about your planning and your rotation and how much you want to grow and stuff. I found it incredibly useful. So I'm trying to be a bit more methodical after all these years.
That's an awesome recommendation. I think, yeah, I'm with you on having a method behind the madness of the veggie garden because, I mean, it's not always about getting abundance of crop, but making sure that there's always something going right, you know, because everything's going to have a downtime. So
yeah, that's true.
It's nice to have at least one thing producing all year round.
And do you often grow, is it called beneficial plants? Do you find with your, you plant those with your veggies?
I don't. Mm-hmm. That said, I do try and do a mix of stuff. So I try not to have a monoculture in any bed. And I do, I've got little alyssums and calendulas and stuff tucked in.
Yep.
But a lot of what I read about the beneficial or companion planting seems to be much more about if you've got, like, growing in the soil. Right? And because I'm in raised beds that are separated from the soil, I'm not so sure. That said, I'm talking to a mate at work about trying to get his verticillium wilt out of the soil and planting mustards in that. So, yes, I do a little bit, but I'm not religious about it. What is it? Chives with carrots or something like that, I think.
There's quite a few. Yeah, I'm not well versed on it, but I know Jackie French produced quite a number of books on complementary planting that are really lovely to read. And whether or not they all work, it's sort of besides the point. Like, sometimes it's just nice to have, like, a plan of things that will go nicely together.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always have to be about complementary for, like, pest issues, but also just nice to have, like, fragrances that blend nicely together. And
And you can plan, like, different. I've mostly read about this in food forest planting, but you know, roots at different depths so that you've got complexity in the soil, but they're not all at the same level and not all competing for the same pocket of nutrients and water as well and stuff like that. So thinking about it in that way.
Wow, that's so in-depth, but of course makes so much sense to think about that.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. And I feel like Jackie, I think she probably tests a lot of stuff in her garden, doesn't she? I always like reading about her wombats.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I follow her on Instagram. And yeah. She has the best wombat content. So good. I've been asked to please repeat who we are. So sorry, everyone. I'm Emma Hurd, and with me in the studio is Amy Downey and Kate Archdeacon, and our wonderful producer, Pia Lefebvre, is in the producer's box helping us out. We've got a few more text messages. Someone says, some Crotalaria are native to Australia. Some have the common name of rattlepod.
Rattlepod.
Oh, yeah.
Because cool. So we were just talking about the seeds. Ooh.
Sounds like it might have a pretty cool seed pod that you could dry out and use as a rattle.
Make some noise with that.
Yeah.
Surprised I haven't heard them blowing in the wind up at the temple.
Yeah, true. And then another question, can you explain what nitrogen fixing means when you say, when you say that? Yeah. So, I'll let you do it, Kate, but yeah.
I'm not the expert though, so jump in. I guess when I'm thinking about it, it's that you can grow crops that bring nitrogen from the air and store it in nodules along the roots of the plants. And so often in crop rotation for vegetable gardening and also for grain growers and things like that, they will intercrop or crop rotate from a hungry crop to something like peas or broad beans that you can put in. And the idea is that they will put nitrogen back into the soil so you can have a something growing all the time, which is returning fertility to the soil. Mm-hmm. Now, where I get a little bit hesitant about pushing that is that I've read also Steve Solomon's stuff, and he's a pretty interesting writer. He says that if you then harvest the pods, all the nitrogen's gone back into producing what you're eating.
So you actually have to till it into the soil.
Yeah, so if you're going to grow nitrogen fixes, you have to grow them and dig them back in before, like once the flower comes on, but before it sets and makes fruit. So this idea that you can kind of have your cake and eat it too doesn't kind of translate. But that's what nitrogen fixing is that if you can leave it where it's still sitting at the roots, then as the roots decay, and of course you shouldn't pull the plant out, but you can cut it off at the sort of soil level and leave the roots in, then it will slowly release the nitrogen back into the soil. And that's what that's about.
Yeah.
That's my take on it.
Yeah, that's spot on. That's along the lines of what I was thinking too. And some people call it a sacrificial crop. But, still you get good value out of it for your soil.
And I think it shows up a lot in permaculture thinking on large scale. So tagacestes, I think, are used for it as a windbreak and fodder crop, and the idea with those is that they're fast growing and you're cutting the leaves and dropping them down for green edible foods for your livestock, and then of course you're not ever digging up those trees, so that's where it shows up as a nitrogen producer in the soil as well. I think in larger scale kind of permaculture designs, I think. It's been a while since my PDC, so sorry if anyone's listening.
No, that's great.
That sounds like really applicable to what we're talking about.
And do you know, again, something I don't know super well, but anything about nitrogen drawdown? Like I know we sort of have the discussion where I use a lot of wood chip mulch at the Grey Garden, and it's something that we don't use often in a lot of the other beds because of the risk of nitrogen drawdown. But do you know much about...
Just that if you're trying to, if you put a lot of woody mulch in like contact with your soil, then the bacteria that, or the microbes that eat, let me see, that would normally be breaking down a little bit of carbon in your soil and using the nitrogen to do that will take extra nitrogen out of your soil so that they can more rapidly break down the carbon that you've added.
And so it's kind of the opposite of it's actually taking nitrogen out of the soil to
You can do things like add so what they say is if you're using something like a straw mulch, say in your veggie patch, there's a couple of things. One, if you're using woody mulch in the garden, maybe try and add extra nitrogen. If you're trying to also get plants started that need a lot of nitrogen, then you need to think about that and maybe try and keep your woody mulch quite dry so that it's not starting to engage with the soil would be one take.
Yep.
And then when in veggie growing, if you've put mulch on your soil to keep it, to protect it over winter, when it's time to put your new crops in and you've got your soil all lovely and ready, don't dig the straw mulch in, lift it off and take it aside and compost it or okay. save it.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you're pulling it off so your soil warms up, just yep. don't dig it in because you'll have the same thing. You'll have that nitrogen drawdown. So it's a really good pickup.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's really good.
It locks
good
it up doing something else. Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Oh, thank you. That's great.
Yeah, no good worries. Understand. As again, I learned this from other people who actually know what they're talking about.
No, that was good. That was perfect.
That's how we learn everything, isn't it?
Yeah. So I may be slightly wrong.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Kate. So I've got a couple more community events to mention. Global Gardens of Peace is running a twilight tour of the Botanic Gardens at Cranbourne. It's going to be led by Tim Sampson, so the Executive Director of Living Collections and Environment at RBGV, and Andrew Laidlaw, who's the Chief Landscape Architect. And it's going to be an extraordinary opportunity to meet the two experts in their working environment. That's kicking off at 4:45 for a 5 p.m. start on the 20th of March. Tickets are $60. And as a lot of you know, Global Gardens of Peace, all their funds go towards creating gardens that are therapeutic and spreading peace across the world. And particularly one of their key focuses for a long time was a beautiful garden in Palestine, which unfortunately has not eventuated, but we'll keep the dream alive. And yes. So the money that from that event will go towards all the wonderful things that Global Gardens of Peace do. There are a lot more events, so I'll just try and get through them kind of quickly. Cranbourne Botanic Gardens as well is having their autumn plant sale. That's next weekend, the 14th and 15th of March, between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. I'll let you look up further details if you need them. Still on plant sale theme, the Australian Plant Society Yarra Yarra are holding their native plant and book sale on the 28th of March. That's a Saturday, 9:30 till 3 p.m. at the Eltham Community and Recreation Centre, 801 Main Road in Eltham. The South Gippsland Garlic Festival. It's Victoria's biggest celebration of Australian garlic. And that's Saturday. Oh, sorry, no, we've missed that one. That's the 28th of Feb. Apologies, everyone. Herb and Chili Festival is coming up on the 15th of March. That's taking place at 125 Quail Road in Wandon. And that will be fun for anyone who likes spicy food and wants to grow their own chilies. And another good one, Jack Semler has just launched her new book called Flower Power. So there's a few events surrounding this wonderful book. There will be a book signing and Q&A at Avenue Bookstore on Thursday the 12th of March, and that's at 6 p.m. It's a free event, and you can book via TryBooking. And an excellent conversation as a part of the Test Garden program, which Jack was heavily involved in at Fed Square. That's coming up on Saturday, the 14th of March at 10 a.m. So that can be booked via fedsquare.com/events/testgarden-open-day-march. That's well a bit done. I'm sure if you have a little look on your search engine, it will come up in relation to that. So that's another free one. And there's, I think that's all. I think that's everything. I've got one more event I'll talk about later in the show, but we'll get back to our text messages because we've got them coming in hot. Hi, I recently divided some bromeliads. These ones don't have the wow factor, and I'm thinking of attaching them to the trunk of my tree fern. Ooh, that's a cool idea. What would that work? And what should I use to attach them to those dead parts of the fern fronds that have died off? They've got some suggestions: string, fishing line, wire. I'd probably go for wire for longevity reasons. And is there anything else I should be aware of, such as whether or not the bromeliads will survive without having their roots in soil or potting mix? I'd say you could try packing in some coconut fiber between the dead fronds of the tree fern and your bromeliad. Probably water is the other consideration. And as many will know, bromeliads like to receive their water through their crown. So if you can just be consistent, especially in the first few years of establishment, because I think they'll be fairly slow to actually adhere to the medium that you're using, whether it's coconut fiber or some sort of moss or soil, even some bark. You can get some nice orchid mix, and maybe you could use some chicken wire to kind of ensure that all of that stays in place. I don't know, do you ladies have any other ideas? Just making sure that water is consistent.
Yeah, I think that was perfect. And I know we've done a little bit, not with bromeliads, but we've done a little bit of similar work, sort of planting in trees with orchids and things like that. Mm. And I know they use a type of, it's sort of like a springy wire to tie it on with, so that then sort of as it grows, it can stretch and it doesn't sort of restrict it. Not that, you know, I think the bromeliads will have much problem. But that's sort of the only different thing, I guess, that they do sometimes at the gardens, is the wire is sort of one that's able to grow and move with the plant.
Yeah.
But I think that's spot on. I think that would look fantastic. That's such a clever idea.
Yeah, I think it's going to look great. Thank you for messaging in.
Thank you.
Are there any trees, shrubs, etc. that are nitrogen fixers for suburban gardens, please? So, yeah, our peas and beans.
I saw that and I was thinking, would Indigofera count? Does that make little pods? Is that a legume?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, okay.
And that's a good one that stays in the ground.
Mm. You know, yeah, because you're not going to eating. Yeah.
Not wanting to turn it over and churn it.
But yeah, you're right. Otherwise, it's like your leafy annuals, not leafy annuals, but you know, your peas and broad beans and things. Yeah. I guess it depends if they're talking about, perennials in and around the garden or in the veggie patch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any trees that you know of?
I feel like, there's anything that makes a pod, really.
Imagine, is that like gladiziums?
There, I'm out of, I'm over to you. Over
maybe,
to you on that
maybe
one.
Maybe robinias?
Yeah. Actually, my mum always talked about, I grew up in North Queensland, I think she always talked about robinias, and there was a few of those around. Tamarind trees, I'm pretty sure, would be a nitrogen fixer with their pod production. That's true. A bit tropical, though.
Yeah. I'm really taking a stab in the dark, though. I'm sorry. I'm not well-versed on my nitrogen-fixing trees.
Sweet peas, I would say, would be a nitrogen-fixing plant for sure. Absolutely. And everyone's pushing their sweet pea seeds at the moment because they're so beautiful. Yeah. Just don't eat them and don't let little kids eat them. Because they're really toxic.
Yeah.
But that's
probably as much as we've got.
Yeah, the Indigofera is the only one I can think of I know of. Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just because I'm a Gardens for Wildlife volunteer, so we're always recommending that as
I
well.
I love that plant anyway. So
yeah, it's a beauty,
great.
Isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Beautiful.
Oh, here's
flowers.
One I should have thought of. Acacias and nitrogen fixing.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Thank you. Nicola from Eltham texted
Thanks,
in for
Nicola.
Us.
Thank you, Nicola.
Yeah, awesome. Yay. And that's a nice native option too.
Mm,
We've got these lovely Acacia glaucoptera in the Grey Garden, which have those amazing swirly seed pods.
Yeah.
I think they just look so cool and so Dr. Zeusy.
Yeah, beautiful.
They've got a lovely seed pod.
There's one. Try that, everyone. Acacia glaucoptera. Sounds great. I will mention this other event. This was sent in by Penny Woodward. So, lovely. I think she mentioned it on a show a couple of weeks ago, but they didn't have the full details. So apologies, I might make some mistakes in pronunciation, but it's called the Womanjika Balnarring Nagari Festival, where the whole community can gather to share and begin conversations and walk with First Nations people. So that's happening on Saturday, the 14th of March this year. And you're invited to join the learnings at the 9th festival. So it's been going for 9 years, which sounds lovely. And it seems like there's lots of events in conjunction with it. There'll be music, there'll be opportunities to engage with lots of different members of the community, and it's a family-friendly event. So entry starts from 10 a.m. and through till 5 p.m. It's at Emu Plains Reserve in Coolart Road, Balnarring, and entry is by donation. So pay as you feel, I think, kind of gold coin. There's food trucks and coffee available, and there'll be lovely music and workshops by First Nations people, and I think some plants for sale as well. So it seems like a beautiful event. I'll make sure that we post that on our Instagram as well. I'll take the opportunity to talk a little bit about an organisation that is close to my heart. They're encouraging women in horticulture. And as it's International Women's Day, it's a good opportunity to talk about them.
Yes.
So they've been running since 2007. They're a volunteer run organization, and they do a lot to sort of just engage women in horticulture, provide events that might be not only good for networking but fun and educational, and also giving a platform for women in horticulture. So they like to host conversations with women in that work all through the field, as well as like design or maybe running nurseries, all sorts of stuff. They also have a scholarship every year and a business grant, so they do lots of good work. Have either of you gone to any of their events?
I haven't, no. Have you?
I have not yet, unfortunately, but it is at the top of my to-do list because I've been aware of them and following them on Instagram for a while, and I just think they're wonderful, and I know a couple of people that are involved and volunteer there, so I really would like to, and it's a must do for me this year. So I'm hoping to get to one. Emma, you obviously have been to some of the
I was lucky enough to be on the committee for it was probably a decade.
I think I did know this. Yes.
Yeah. And amazing. I was fortunate. I was president for a couple of years as well.
Yep.
And then, since have had my baby and taken a break from that volunteer work. But
yes.
Yeah, hopefully one day we'll get back into the swing of things.
Yes.
I'm a bit light on time for going to events. So unfortunately, I haven't been as engaged as I have in previous years.
Totally understandable. Yes.
They do great work though. And I know everyone on the committee works so hard to put the events together. So kudos to them.
Yes.
I'm just looking when their next event is. They also have a really great newsletter called Verdant. So if you don't have the capacity to join up as a member because, cash is tight, you can still go to events, and you can also register for their newsletter, which always has some great articles in it, and they always have a hort hero, so a woman in horticulture that they platform and profile in every newsletter.
How wonderful.
So their next event is March the 21st. It's Coastal Plants and Garden Tour of Shoreham, Shoreham Native Nursery, and a visit to Joe Ferguson's private garden in Flinders. So that's a really beautiful event.
Yes.
I'm sure you can find all the information you need on their website.
It's a busy weekend, that weekend.
Yeah.
That's right. It's all happening.
It is huge. So, yeah. But I can vouch that that will be a fun one. And Jo Ferguson's wonderful as well. Have either of you been to her garden in Flinders?
No.
It's so beautiful. Mm. I know Global Gardens of Peace did a twilight event at her garden a few years ago. It's well worth a visit. So,
Yeah. Lovely.
Definitely recommend.
That's great.
I wouldn't mind mentioning a couple of upcoming free events, if that's okay, Smart Garden. Yes. We've got, I think, 4 or 5 listed on our website at the moment, which is mysmartgarden.org.au. And there's one that's coming up with seed saving with Sunita, and that's out in the Wyndham area, so out sort of Tarneit way, and that's a local amazing gardener who opens her garden for open garden tours every so often and teaches people how to propagate or save seed. And her garden is absolutely full of really interesting, edible, diverse plants. So if you're out that way, that's a good one. We've got another one that I just wanted to mention coming up on the 24th of March. It's a nighttime. So we try and offer one online one at least sort of every month so that everyone can go. And we offer it in the evening. And that's one that Kat Lavers is going to be teaching, and it's Designing Your Garden. Awesome. And she's a permaculture instructor, a very experienced instructor, and understands well the challenges of small space design, small space gardening, and has a lot of experience of growing things in pots as well. So there should be something for everyone.
Yes.
So it's the perfect time of year to be thinking about that as well. So we've got quite a few coming up. There's walking tours, but we try to have one hero one every month or so, and that's going to be a cracker. So, yeah.
That sounds wonderful.
Should be good.
Yes.
And how do people find info about these events? Is there a website they should go to?
Absolutely. So mysmartgarden.org.au, and that's got our whole events thing on there. It's also got – we produce – anytime we hold a webinar or a workshop, we – create resources from that as well. So we've just put up recordings from our last 2 webinars, so you can go back and watch the composting and bokashi one we were talking about before, and the preserving one. Both of those videos are up as well, and it's really easy, and you can sign up to our newsletter as well, and then you'll always get an alert for when there's new events coming up.
So awesome. It's so valuable, all these free events that you're providing. So are they all funded through local councils?
Yeah. So the 10 partner councils chip in the same amount of money, and we put that into a central fund. It pays for my time and then all of the platforms like the website and things like that. But then each partner council also resources the provision of 6 workshops a year on behalf of their own council. And this is where I love it, because it's the project officer within that council who might be in community development, they might be in urban agriculture, they might be in biodiversity, but they're the ones that are talking to their residents, and they're the ones that decide what the workshops need to be for the year. And so we have 5 themes. So it's food, waste, habitat, water and shelter. But then the officer is the one who gets to kind of have the decision making about what that should be, which community centre it needs to be in, or whether it's going to be at the Heritage Orchard in Werribee, or, you know, we've got some coming up in Yarra where Jane's taking people walking around to see the community gardens in Fitzroy and things. So it's their expertise that then comes into play about what they know their residents need as well, and what the council is trying to promote in terms of whether it's biodiversity or food security or engaging, you know, multi-generational things, which was what Mornington Peninsula was concentrating on a lot last year. So it's really diverse, and it's always interesting. And a couple of years ago I did an exhibition for the team of all of the workshops that they'd offered in the previous 18 months, and the breadth of things was extraordinary. And so I really feel like, even though it sounds very simple, that it's a, you know, it's a gardening workshop of some sort, and it's just in the neighborhood center or the library or something like that, how we know from the feedback that we get that people are extremely likely, 85% to 90% likely, to apply what they learn when they come to the workshops. And that's sort of an impact.
Amazing.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And it is.
It's so simple, but it's taken 12 years, 13 years to get it to this point, but the impact is extraordinary, and that's what we really focus on, is passing on the skills.
I love that you sort of, you know, allow for the councils to let you know what people are interested in, and sort of, I guess that's why the success is so high. I think that's so good. And
having community feedback is so valuable.
Yeah.
And actually listening and following through.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also thinking, you know, we've all just done our 5-year plans for municipal health and wellbeing and climate emergency strategy and things like that. So it's also offering the things that people might not be thinking about yet. And so one of my obsessions at the moment is trying to get more information out there about balcony gardening, because we've got all these density targets in some of our councils. Yeah. And balcony gardening can be so abundant and rewarding.
I think it intimidates people though as well. So sort of
absolutely,
you know, educating on that and demystifying it.
Yeah, yeah.
And just giving people inspiration and
and
confidence.
Good solid knowledge as well, so that they're not just spending money and then failing because the pots were too small and they dried out too quickly or
That's actually a really valuable element that I forgot to mention about RBGV's work, and it's been spoken about a lot on air before, so I won't labour the point too much, but talking about succession and climate readiness. So it's wonderful to hear that councils are engaged in that too.
Absolutely.
So really future-proofing and using all the tools we have to make sure we're picking plants that are going to be resilient.
I think also, like, the where I find, and I'm really pushing my smart garden now, but we know that so much of the land in cities or suburbs is privately owned, so where council can, you know, come up with a plan for the climate resilient, you know, urban forestry or open space, what this program offers the opportunity for is to try and get that knowledge being developed in the residential space as well. And we're not the experts. The, you know, the people that manage the parks and the urban forest aren't necessarily the ones that know about balcony gardening, and that's why our kind of case studies and peer-to-peer learning is also really important. So the people that are doing it and then can pass on information back to everyone else is really important, because they're the ones that are doing it on a day-to-day basis. And we talked a lot, didn't we, about, like, book learning versus learning from others. And I think that's somewhere that I really want to take the program even more. When I say I take it, I just do what all my team, I just do what they tell me to do. They're like, fix this. I'm like, okay.
But you need the doers.
They drive it. Yeah.
Yeah, you need the doers.
They're the thinkers. And you need someone to fix the website or the newsletter when it breaks. I can do that.
That's a, but that's a team, isn't it? It's great.
Absolutely.
You all play your important role.
Yeah.
I was going to say as well, like, when so much of a city is privately held, it's so wonderful to hear that you're engaging with individual owners, but also I wonder, like, have you found there's many opportunities to engage with private stakeholders and sort of, like, see if you can commandeer whether they're like give back a little bit to
Well, it's interesting, there's two things, and I know we're running low on time. There's two things. We generally engage about 6,000 people a year across the program, so we know that we have quite a good cut through in terms of people either thinking about what we're teaching or actually showing up and learning it. As we know, showing up on a Saturday morning is a hot, totally different thing. So there's that. But I just want to do a shout out as well. So City of Melbourne have just released their next Urban Forest Fund. They're not partners of ours, but I wish they were, but they're not. But there's some really great stuff happening in cities around the world. But what they've done is they've always had this fund for, like, greening the city, but this year they've separated it into two streams. One's quite large scale, it's the kind of thing that produces the Sky Farm in Docklands, but the other one's the community stream,
which is really cool. If you haven't been, go to the Sky Farm. Sorry.
But yeah, no, that's okay. But the what they've done is set aside a heap of money for people living in Melbourne to visibly green their space, so their private land. There's a couple of things. It will be funded. It's match funding. The greening has to be thought out so that it will be maintained over time and make a difference over time, so not just kind of dies next month and blah. It needs to be visible to others or accessible to others. So it's not just greening your back balcony that no one else can see, but if it's overlooked. And so it's really building on the good nature stuff that, you know, visible greenery is good for mental health and diverse greenery is good for physical and mental health. And if you do it on your own behalf, you can do it on other people's behalf as well.
And I want to see more corporate organisations getting involved absolutely. In sort of giving that back.
And they are private landowners. Yeah. They could do this, absolutely.
And especially when some of it's like disused land or even like roof areas, yeah. things like that.
I was going to say, can this even include those like green walls and things?
Absolutely, and buildings it is. And, yeah, yeah. And the nice thing about the Urban Forest Fund is it's funded from the loss of trees in the City of Melbourne area. So right. That money is feeding back into benefiting greenery. But the only other thing I think is really cool about the program is they've come up with greening permits. So if you're trying to green on private land but it encroaches into public land, you just get a permit for it.
Mm.
And they've fast-tracked yeah. it. I'm fascinated to see how it turns out. I think it's really well thought
yes,
through.
Yes, absolutely.
That's very exciting.
It's so exciting.
Yeah, and so there that was released recently.
Yeah, I went to the launch, I think, a month ago.
Yeah.
And there's case studies from previous grant recipients, and it's really good information. It's well worth a read because setting the precedent is the hardest thing for local government.
Yeah,
you know, and then everyone goes, "Oh, it is possible." It's, yeah. you know, it seems impossible, but it's actually possible.
Yeah, mm. Thank you so much for highlighting
yes.
that.
Yes,
that's fantastic.
It is,
and yeah, City of Melbourne kind of does take a leadership role in Victoria.
Mm.
So. Hopefully yeah. there'll be other councils that follow that idea.
Absolutely. Someone was telling me you can map in the City of Melbourne, you can do a map of like how to get from one point to the other under the most amount of shade.
Cool.
That
because they've mapped their canopy.
Awesome.
I yes. love it.
There's, so yeah. clever. Yeah.
There'll be shade boffins out there.
Oh, no, go left at little Flinders Lane and then right onto it. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I know, slightly different, but sort of going back to as well what you were saying about letting the council tell you what people are wanting to know and interested in. And I know Sale Botanic Gardens were sharing, because they look after a lot of the street trees and things like that too. And they were saying that they had noticed they would give landowners and homeowners the option of sort of being able to pick their own two trees. And I'm sure within, you know, the climate suited and all those things, but choose their own ones that they wanted in their front nature strip.
Mm.
And they said that the percentage of trees that they had lost drastically went down. Like the survival of these trees went up massively. Like the percentage was huge of just letting people
bit pick. Of ownership.
Exactly. Mm. They felt responsible and they wanted to keep them alive and do what they could for their trees because they picked them.
How interesting.
Isn't it wonderful?
Mm. How did you hear about that?
So when I, with this the stenostoma that we collected, I went down, it was wonderful, to Sale Botanic Gardens to give them a couple of the stenostoma that they're going to grow on there. They are doing some incredible work, and I fear I wouldn't give it justice even trying to talk about it, but they are doing some amazing work down there, not only with their botanic gardens but with developing some of their natural spaces and restoring them. They gave me a massive tour and they look after so much space, so much area. So I just got to hear a little bit about the work they're doing, and it's honestly, they're doing incredible stuff. So
amazing.
I hope they may get to share more about what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll have to do a phone chat
yeah,
with someone
we really
from
should.
Sale.
Yeah, yeah. I could connect with them and ask them. I'm sure they'd be interested. And I know they have upcoming programs and things like that too. So even to get some info out there about them, because it's really impressive and I was mind blown getting to just see some of the works they're doing.
Mm,
it's amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, very cool.
We can
cool.
talk more
road
off
trip.
Mic about that.
Yeah, yeah, road, yeah. Trip. Road trip.
Well, we are fast approaching the end of this wonderful show. Thank you so much to Amy Downey and
Thank
Kate
you.
Archdeacon for being in the studio with me. I'm Emma Hurd. And we've got Pia in the producer's box. Thank you, Pia. One thing I'll just leave everyone with about International Women's Day, I read a lovely article published on the Australian Geographic website. It's called 17 Incredible Australian Women in Botany. Mm. It was actually published in 2019, but still beautiful, beautiful article to read today to give you some good feels about women in botany and gardening. So if you've got the time today, please have a read.
Yes.
Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks for joining in, and you'll hear different people on the mics next week. Mm. See you later.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.